ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia has read them, argued over them, recommended them, and let them out, sometimes never to be seen again. Which are the greatest Australian books? Have your say in the ABC Radio National Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. Vote now at abc.net.au/top100books.
It is 1932, and right now there is a group of men over there who are crouching in the dusty red dirt, the West Australian wheat belt.
So it's a major, a brigadier, a couple of soldiers, these two guns, and a merry band of farmers, and whatever rifles, shotguns that they can take with them.
They get into position, and they have their enemy in their sights.
They're loading up, they're aiming, and the guns jam.
They curse, they swear, but they do not give up. They race towards the enemy instead.
They start to requisition vehicles, trucks and cars. They're basically chasing them down because they're trying to keep up with them.
But what these men don't yet realise is that their enemy moves way faster than they think. Their enemy will dash and dart around their bullets and race well ahead of their cars. Because the enemy these men are trying to kill is a bird.
The emu.
This is what happens when a country decides to go to war with a flightless bird. But the true opponent is something much larger and more formidable.
This is a story of not really coming to terms with the Australian environment. It's a story of hubris.
My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to the first in our mini-series, This Stupid War. And for the next four episodes, we are diving into some of the weirdest conflicts in history. Conflicts started by a pig, a pastry, yes, even emus. But at the time, no one, except maybe the emus, saw it coming. So I want you to imagine something for me. This is going to sound weird, but my job is weird sometimes.
Sure.
I want you to imagine that between us right now is a fully grown emu.
And I would run that way.
That person who I want you to imagine running away from you, that would be Ruth Morgan.
I'm a historian at the ANU in Canberra, and I work on environmental history. So really interested in, well, often Australian history, but how people's relationships with place and the environment, quite broadly defined, have changed over time.
And tonight, we are going to war with nature.
We are. Look, it's a common metaphor and it comes up time and time again for a reason.
This very strange war begins where another war ends, the Great War, World War I. In 1918, the armistice was signed and tens of thousands of Aussies at that point have been killed. World War I is just a devastating conflict for Australians. And the soldiers that made it home, they're not doing well.
It's, on the one hand, a young settler nation and has believed that it has proven itself on the battlefield, but it's also an anxious nation because all of these men and their experiences of the war are coming back
to Australia. A lot of trauma.
A lot of trauma. It's not a massive population either. So most people will have known someone or had family members who have been at war and they're coming back. But there's also a lot of anxiety about what this influx of damaged veterans might look like. And the overwhelming mood is that we don't really want these men congregating in cities where they might start to band together, they might be a cause of social unrest.
So too many traumatised people that know how to use guns, let's separate them.
Absolutely.
So this was a real concern, by the way. There were other countries that had uprisings like your Russias and whatnot. And so what are they going to do with these men to have them not congregate in the cities and, I don't know, maybe overthrow the government?
Well, that would be a dire outcome as far as everyone's concerned. So this isn't a unique situation to Australia. It's a British Empire strategy, really, to settle these men on the land. So there's an idea that rural life is going to help restore these men to their health, their manliness, and there's going to be benefits for the nation because then there will be more farmers, these will not be congregating dangerously in cities, and they will then boost the productivity of the nation.
And so 5,000 of these men and their families are sent to Western Australia.
So it's a masculinist ideal. They're going to be the breadwinners and the providers for their families out on these rural properties.
The government is calling this scheme the Land Fit for Heroes. But it's a bit of a problem.
A lot of the very good farming land has already been claimed. So there's already a wheat belt at this point, but they are moving further east, so into what is marginal land, where rainfall is a bit more patchy. So some of this land hasn't been farmed by farmers before, by Anglo-Europeans.
The existing wheat belt kind of runs along the bottom of Western Australia, kind of near Perth, and particularly on the edges of the belt, which is really where these soldiers were being settled, it's very flat, very hard-packed land.
It was covered in scrub, trees and so on. Some of the challenges, I suppose, for these returned soldiers is that they have to clear this land themselves. And that is hard work. And a lot of them aren't really capable. They're not in a position to do this. Some of them have farming experience. A lot more of them don't. Or they don't have farming experience in that kind of country.
So it's already hard. Plus you're carrying a bunch of trauma. You've got land that hasn't necessarily been kind of graded and readied up for this. But there's another problem. They're not the only living things on these lands. There's also animals.
Yeah. All the introduced species, like rabbits in particular, foxes, wild dogs that make their way across Australia and flourish in these environments. And then there are the native animals that think, oh, well, now you guys are creating this environment that's very ideal for us.
But one of the most destructive animals, or at least for these farmers, is, of course, the native emu.
They're cool, but they are also really big. They're like up to 2 metres tall. They're
bigger than us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And they're a bit, you know, they've got sharp beaks. They can really peck and just don't want to be too close. I can see they can be a bit cheeky. Yeah, so I just sort of keep my distance, that's all.
So if you were to run away from our imaginary emu that's in front of us, who would win that race?
Oh, I think the emu, quite easily. It wouldn't be the most informed strategy on my part to run, but...
So I'm getting tall, yep. I'm getting strong, I'm getting fast.
Yes, all things that I'm not.
I'm also getting formidable.
Yeah, absolutely. They've been around for a very long time. They know what they're doing. Yep.
And in the thousands of years that our formidable enemy has been roaming these lands, what's been the emu's traditional migration? Like, how do they move around the continent?
Well, the ones that's least in Western Australia, the ones I'm more familiar with, they tend to, you know, get around. They can move hundreds and hundreds of kilometres to get what they want, to go towards food, to go towards water sources. And they then kind of flock together and build up these big contingents and they get on the move.
Righto, so we have our 2 metre tall bird with razor sharp beak that can run like the wind. That is a huge problem for farmers because whatever crop they've managed to grow at this point is now being trampled on or munched on by these massive animals.
They're weighing about 50 kilos, so they're flattening the wheat and they don't come just one by one. So you're getting a stampede through your wheat field, which is not ideal. And they're eating it.
They're eating the wheat.
Yeah. They're like, great, you've made a buffet for me, basically. And they're drawn to it. And it's not only the wheat that they're drawn to the water supplies that are now popping up through this area that would ordinarily only have seasonal water.
So the emus are stealing water, which is a particular problem because in 1932, there's a massive drought.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a season that is very nerve-wracking for the farmers because they're starting to think, is this going to be like 1914, which is a really bad drought for Western Australia and was one of the, I suppose, push factors in a lot of men enlisting for war. They were like, well, we might as well go to the front because there's not much for us here. And so they're sensitive to that experience. And they are also thinking, well, I've just planted all this wheat and now, you know, I'm not going to be able to sell it. So this is a very difficult moment as far as they're concerned.
At this point, these farmers have been growing wheat, or trying to, for just over a decade. And in that time, they had been asking the West Australian government to help them tackle this emu problem. And the West Australian government didn't do very much.
There was a real sense for these men that they are being abandoned. They're not getting much traction, I suppose, with Perth, their government, and they also feel very isolated.
Now, there were some existing measures to keep animals away from crops. The most famous one would be the rabbit-proof fence, which by this point in history had been around for around 30 years.
That's one of the earliest infrastructure attempts to deal with this problem. And unfortunately, though, they're a little bit late.
That fence, well, I mean, it didn't really keep the rabbits out, and it certainly was no better at keeping the emus out.
Because they're running at the fences. It seems as though the fences were not sort of the kind of materials that we might expect today. They're not very tall, but we know that emus can jump. They will run parallel. They will run along the fence until they can come in. So this is not ideal as far as protecting the farms.
Eventually, the Federal Minister for Defence, he takes pity on the farmers and decides, you know what, we need to do something.
He says, okay, I will allow you to take two machine guns and you can have a couple of soldiers and off you go. So it's a major, a brigadier, a couple of soldiers, these two guns, machine guns, and a merry band of farmers and whatever rifles, shotguns that they can take with them.
They also had an RSPCA person with them, right?
Oh, look, I don't think he lasts very long. he seems to turn up for a day. He has a knife and a gun, and the army representative, the major at the time, says, well, we're not going to let any of them suffer. But
okay.
RSPCA gentleman is there to, he says, I'm very sympathetic to the farmers, but we don't want any birds to suffer.
You've got this strike force emu, which is what I will persist with
very
calling
good.
It. Historically inaccurate, but cooler.
Yes.
So they arrive from all over the country. They arrive in WA.
Yep.
How does the first battle go?
Look, not according to plan.
Right.
It turns out that while a machine gun might have been useful on the Western Front, for instance, industrial warfare, this is where it's at, emus are either impervious to the bullets, as far as they can tell.
What?
In that they don't seem to be easy to kill.
But it's got feathers on it.
Yeah. There's a real sense among the military and the press that are on the ground and the farmers that these emus are brave. They're tough. They can resist our tactics. And the birds scatter. They run zigzag. They aren't, you know, doing what they're supposed to do and being easily knocked over.
Some people surmise that the emu's got like ultra tough skin, or that the feathers are somehow acting as a buffer, like a force field. Whatever it is, the emus are harder to shoot and kill than these men realise. And just put yourself in their shoes, right? Because years they've had of these birds eating their wheat, they've been asking the government for help, then finally they got these guns. And the guns aren't working. And once the press pick up on it, things spiral.
They are describing the emus as, you know, soldiers of their own. They're in battalions. There's brigadiers and generals on that side as well.
And of course, you can thank the press for the title, The Emu War.
It's obviously all very tongue-in-cheek. I think a lot of it is very imaginative journalism, we might say. But this is not going the way that certainly the farmers on the ground would have wanted. And usually, this is why we don't tend to use machine guns to hunt them. And Indigenous peoples are not hunting them like this. They're going after the individual. They're not doing this. So we can see why it might not have turned out so well.
I just want to know if an emu can open up a door like the velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
Possibly.
Possibly. You're an academic. I'll take it.
I wouldn't put it past them. I wouldn't want to underestimate them. That's clear.
Not only do the emus appear to be impervious to the machine guns, then, just when you thought it couldn't get any worse,
the guns jam.
The farmers make this interesting choice next. Instead of trying to shoot the emus from afar, they decide they're going to get closer to them. They're going to chase them down to, I don't know, tackle them?
They start to requisition vehicles, trucks and cars. They're jumping in, they're getting their guns, and they're going after these creatures. So they're basically chasing them down because they're trying to keep up with them. The distance of their guns is an issue. They need to be able to keep up. Whether that's a wily tactic, maybe on the behalf of the emu, but they are then finding, well, we have to be on the move as well. We have to go after them.
Okay, so this is not going well. Do they regroup at some point?
They do. So after a few days, certainly the military folk go back to Perth. So they get on the train, head back, think about what they've been doing.
Have a long, hard think about the choices that you have made.
Is this worth continuing, chaps? Mm.
The thing is, when you look back over history, usually when a war comes to an end, there's an ending. Like, there's a climax. A city is bombed, a king is beheaded, one side concedes, something happens. But this war against the emus, it sort of ends with a whimper. There's no official end, which in some ways is fitting because there was no official beginning either. I mean, that title, The Emu War, was a press creation. What certainly began as a conflict against this big bird, when you look back on it, in some ways it's actually a war against the very environment that these settlers found themselves in. Like, it's a very young settler culture for these men. When they went into battle here with something that they just didn't quite understand and certainly were not capable of controlling.
This young nation, this manly, masculinist society is going to prove itself on the stage with its production of wheat and wool for the imperial market and all these sorts of things. It's like a battle in a bigger war against the Australian landscape.
Okay, so, like, in terms of casualties, right, as far as I can see here, there's about 986 emus that were killed in this particular campaign from November 12th to December 10th. That's, you know, nearly 1,000. And actually, when you count on the injuries and the ones that died afterwards, you got another, I think, more than 2,000 later on. As much as some of this is entertaining, that to me seems like a pretty significant kill count. Was that number not regarded as being successful, or were they just overwhelmed by the tens of thousands more?
Yeah, I think this is... To us, that does seem like a lot. I mean, gosh, that would seem like a successful effort, but you're talking about really a drop in the ocean. And I suspect, I know they are the official figures, but whether we can really trust them, given how, I suppose, the parody of the situation, they might have been trying to make themselves
look good. How dare you question our service people.
Exactly. I'm terribly sorry.
As the whole emu war comes to a close, the government is very aware that the emus still have the upper hand. God, that's a strange sentence to say out loud. So the Department of Agriculture, they offer this incentive. Anyone who can bring in an emu beak will get some cash.
This makes a tidy little earner for people who are labouring out in the wheat belt, people who are unemployed, bounty hunters who make this their job, basically, to hunt the emus.
How much money do I get if I bring you a beak?
Something like a few shillings. You're probably needing quite a few beaks to make much headway. And there was a bit of a controversy because people would try to pass off old beaks, dried up beaks. Ooh. So you want a fresh beak.
You need CSI beak.
You do need CSI beak to make sure that this is a fresh emu or a recently departed emu and not one that you maybe tackled a little while ago.
Well, it's interesting because, like, I was just looking, I've got the numbers here.
Oh, there
in front
you go.
Of me, and it's like, it does, they collect a lot of beaks. So I'm going to try and get the exact number. So from 1945 to 1960, 284,724 beaks were recorded. I mean, that's certainly a fair bit more than the, you know, the mere 2,000, 3,000 that were collected in the official emu war. If we view success through the lens of dead emus, is that an effective win?
It doesn't seem to solve the problem in the sense that one season they've knocked the emu problem, the emu menace, on the head. To say that it works, I'm not sure, because they still need fences and they're still going out each season and doing this, but it seems to be the only strategy that they are willing to entertain.
one of the reasons I like the story is that it obviously has a funny component to it, but there's also like a, there's a darkness to it, which is you've got, you know, traumatized service people who have been asked to spread out across the country, asked to build lives with, you know, extreme trauma from World War One. And it also kind of speaks a little bit to what happens to colonists and settlers in this country when you're in land that, you know, that is not necessarily designed for you. That's me putting that diplomatically. It kind of reveals something at the very core of Australia, which is just how challenging that settler colonialism actually is for all parties.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this is, you're right. You can see where, well, it becomes the Anzac legend, but before that we have the pioneer legend. We have this history of trying to, this experience of hardship, and that this is where the Australian spirit is made, through these sorts of rugged endurance in these frontier conditions. Should they have been out there? Should they have been put out there to struggle? I think we continue to grapple with that history. And it is interesting how, I suppose, we have this story of where European farming practices are trying to be established in hostile territory with devastating impacts for those families, as you say, for the Indigenous peoples there, and then, of course, for the environment. And it ends up undermining the agricultural project, because already you're starting to see dryland salinity in this part of the country, and that devastates a huge tract of Western Australia.
The emu was considered a pest by the settlers, but of course Indigenous Australians held a very different view.
Not a pest as far as Indigenous people are concerned. You have emu dreamings, this sort of great cultural significance of emus. Their eggs are important. They're going to be symbols and signs of changing weather conditions and seasonal change and so on. And they're an amazing food source and resource overall. So it's quite a different outlook to what the farmers were bringing to the table.
Do you think when Strike Force Emu was making its way across the wheat belt, do you think they could have seen coming how it was going to play out?
It's hard to say. I think it must have been a real sense of desperation, a real sense that we have to do something. And I think important context here is that they not only had the dry conditions of 1932, but they weren't that far out of the Great Depression. So wheat prices were really low. And then a genius strategy, and I don't use that in a positive sense, was, well, grow more wheat, not recognising that that would perhaps depress the price even further. And so they've got enormous amounts of wheat that they can't get any money for. The farmers are so cheesed off with the authorities that they're actually starting to really get quite angry. And so this idea of keeping the farmers out of the city because they might be troublesome actually makes them troublesome out there.
Yeah.
And I think there is this boiling up of resentment. And I think this helps us understand why the government gives in to their requests, because they're saying, look, we're going to really make problems for you if you don't throw us a bone here.
Why do you think this story has persisted in the imagination for so many people? Is it just that it's funny, or is there more to it than that?
I think it's so unusual, because it's not as though we don't hear military metaphors when we talk about the environment. I think that's relatively common in Australia when we look at other, we'll look at natural disasters. And this, for these people at the time, this was something of a disaster as far as they were concerned. But I think what's unusual about this particular episode, we can read about it. And we've also got footage of this absurd episode. So I think there is something incredible about the moment, and something that I think is just incredibly entertaining for people.
When you look back at this particular war, like, what do you think the lessons are?
I'd say that the lessons are probably familiar ones in Australian history of trying to be too ambitious, I would say. It's a story of hubris, really, of trying to cultivate closer settlement or mixed farming in environmentally marginal areas is always going to be a high-risk strategy. You've got market forces against them with the Depression. You've got the weather against them with drought. This is a story of not really coming to terms with the Australian environment.
This actually came to us from Alex, who's in year six, who really wanted us to do it. So, Alex, thank you for taking us on this adventure. It's been wild, hasn't it?
It has been quite a wild time, Alex. So thank you for making this suggestion, and I hope it's answered some of your questions.
And also thank you to you for being the one that took us through one of the stranger wars in Australia's history.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's been really fun.
Dr. Ruth Morgan there, Director of the ANU Centre for Environmental History. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Jesse Kay. The sound engineer was Angie Grant. And of course, it is the very first episode in our special series, This Stupid War. We are going to dive into a new conflict next week. My question to you is, can you guess what the conflict is? That will be in your feeds next week. I'm Mark Fennell, and thank you so much for listening to No One Saw It Coming. It is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia, for ABC Radio National. I'm Mark Fennell. I'll see you then. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.